There you go. So, how's the volume? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. Good. Wow, Wendy. Hi. Got people and Caspar, people from overseas. This is exciting. Yeah, so good morning and happy almost spring. I mean, yesterday was a little bit more springy, but today's not bad. And I hope you've managed to set your clocks, let's see, forward. Yes, forward. And that you've checked your fire detector batteries. So, and thank you too for continuing to practice together in this pale virtual facsimile of our usual practice together. And I say that because to me it speaks to our deep and abiding intention to live differently and with greater care for our world. So it gives me a lot of encouragement to know that that intention is there. So thank you very much. I hope there's one day that we can meet in person soon, but for now we have this and we have technology, so not too bad. We can deal with that. So I told Kate and Michael that the title of my talk would be something about dropping fear. Why did I want to talk about fear? Well, actually, my interest began with the topic of fearlessness or offering fearlessness. And I read that in during our practice period in the autumn in Norman's book about the paramitas called The World Could Be Otherwise. But then I also became curious about fear itself. These days, fear sometimes seems to surround us. There's a fear of catching a deadly virus, fear that if you're a person of color, the appearance of a police officer could put your life at risk. Fear that disaffected members of society will see that a strong fascistic leader will provide a simple solution. And of course, fear of the effects of the climate emergency on billions of fellow Earth residents. I think our fearful instincts can sometimes protect us and be very helpful in encouraging us to plan ahead, to act cautiously, and to reach out to others. These fearful instincts, however, can go a little bit overboard and paralyze us with anxiety, doubt, defensiveness, and distancing beyond what is helpful. In this talk, I'd like to share what I've learned about the way fear informs how we are in the world, how it reinforces an us and them mentality, and what some other teachers have thought about it. I also hope I can encourage you to investigate how your fear manifests in the world and ways you might expand your perspective on fear. And finally, I'll talk about offering fearlessness as a practice of generosity. So I'll talk a bit about my experience and about things I've been studying recently and how what I've learned has opened this topic for me. It's going to be a bit of a mashup, but I'll try. So the Buddha recognized that fear is a big motivation to come to practice. He taught followers about the five great fears. There are a few different lists, but they're all pretty similar, but different language. The list that I kind of related to describes these fears as the fear of death, the fear of illness, the fear of losing your mind, the fear of losing your livelihood, and the fear of public speaking. Yes. I think that the reason Buddhism calls these great fears is because each of them mobilizes the full force of our nervous system's threat response. And that's why the panicky fear of public speaking is included in the list. So I won't speak specifically about each of these right now, but as I go along and talk, you'll see how these themes come up in various teachings, ancient and modern, with the modern adapting to reflect our world today and describe it in current language. So I think fear is not always just a simple intermittent response to certain circumstances, but can become an attitude towards life that we carry around with us like heavy chains. It goes beyond self-preservation and survival. It's also that part of us that feels the tightness, holding back, self-protection, and defensiveness. And the result of carrying around this attitude becomes a habit, and we end up saying things that may be less than kind, do things that are questionable, that can mess with our relationships, and ultimately our own health and state of mind. It can close us off from others and from a sense of belonging. It's the seed of suffering, as we desire those things that will quell fear or aversion, as fear pushes away those things that cause the fear. Here's an example of how I recently experienced an unhelpful type of fear. It was when Michael called me up a few weeks ago and asked if I could give a talk. My first response was a low-level panic with thoughts like, oh, gee, I don't know what I would talk about. There are so many other great, learned, and wise teachers who've offered talks at our Sangha. Who am I to say anything? I have no ideas. I'm just, you know, not that experienced. And I realized that this was my imposter syndrome popping up, which is like a first line of defense for me. Rather than thinking, hey, my friend Michael wants a bit of help, or Mountain Rain wants a bit of help, perhaps I could offer something. Or, yeah, I guess Norman Fisher asked me to be a shuso at one time, so I must have thought I could safely share my Dharma with others. Nope, went straight to fear. But I nonetheless agreed to give this talk. I'm not sure why, but I felt like it was the right thing to do. I gently put aside my imposter syndrome, and I'm still not sure why I agreed to give this talk, because I still felt anxious, but I was able to see the stories that were racing through my mind. Maybe this fear will continue up to and including this talk, but I know everything will be okay, whatever happens. No guarantees that I won't come across as an imposter or that I'll give a scintillating talk, but I'll try, because somebody might find it helpful, entertaining, or just a good break from sitting. The whole experience reminded me of something that's been on my mind and in my heart the last few months. During our autumn practice period, as I mentioned, we talked about and studied the paramitas, or the six perfections that define the path of a bodhisattva, which is the path to compassion and awakening. As part of my practice period study, I took another look at Norman Fisher's book called The World Could Be Otherwise. This book is a description of the paramitas from his point of view, and the first chapter is about generosity, and that's the one that really resonated for me. Norman describes the traditional Buddhist view of generosity as having three parts: material, so actual physical or material gifts, spiritual teaching and inspiration, and finally fearlessness. And I found that including fearlessness as a part of generosity kind of amazing, as I hadn't seen it that way before. As I reread the chapter, it struck me that yes, receiving this gift of fearlessness as a type of generosity has been a big part, a transformational part of my Zen experience. So how does one give a gift of fearlessness? Norman says, you give it by giving love. Because when you feel loved, you feel confident. To give the gift of fearlessness is to give others the sense that they matter, that they are respected, cared for, secure within a loving reality, and therefore ultimately protected. How many times have I come away from Dokusan with Norman or one of my other teachers feeling this way, even if not many words were said, or even if I thought the words at the time were unsatisfactory? I still feel this spaciousness and sense of safety, and that warmth just continues to flow through me. And once you experience that, you're changed. And once you're changed by this, you realize you can offer it to others. And how great is that? As for why a bodhisattva gives fearlessness, Norman says it's because, and I quote, they have genuine confidence that there really is nothing to fear, because love actually is built into the order of reality. Knowing that reality is inherently generous and loving certainly doesn't mean bad things can't happen. Shame, loss, physical pain, and of course death are part of life. They are folded into the bodhisattva's imaginative vision of the path ahead. Everything that exists will one day not exist. This is how existence works. This is its beauty and its source of bounty. Following our practice period in the study of paramitas, I studied the Sandokai, or the harmony of difference and equality. And Vicky and Kay and Flo talked about it in February. So if you're interested and want to learn more, you can go back to those recorded talks. The Sanyokai was a favorite of Shunryu Suzuki's, and his lectures on the sutra are recorded in a book called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. The sutra is often chanted in Zen centers, including Mountain Rain. You may recall that this sutra begins with the lines, "The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors." Because of the impact of reading about Norman's writing on generosity and fearlessness, it had an impact and basically focused my studies on the Sandokai. It seemed to me to get to the heart of what Norman had said about reality being inherently generous and love being built into the order of reality. I see the harmony of difference and equality as an encouragement to go beyond self and other and see that self is the world. No separation, just complete interrelatedness. And the more we can absorb and manifest this understanding, the less fear holds us in its grip. Here are a few lines from the sutra that remind me of this. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid, eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. Thus, for each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Or in later lines, light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Overall, it's a beautiful poem, and that's how I appreciated it for a long time. However, there's a lot in it, including references to Zen history, or some might say mythology. And what I bring today only explores one aspect of what I think the sutra teaches. At its heart, I think, is the intimate connection of everything in the world. Some might describe this as the complete interpenetration of everything in the world. Some might describe this as non-duality and non-separation. Complete interpenetration of the relative and absolute, or non-duality or non-separation. One way I think of the absolute is as the realm where things simply exist or events occur, completely whole within each moment, before our human individual minds discriminate among all of these events, assign meaning to them, and value to them. Are they good or bad? Helpful or unhelpful? I think that realm is described in the lines, phenomena exist like box and cover joining, principle accords like arrow points meeting. The lines remind me of how a First Nations wooden blanket box seals so tightly that when the lid is put on, you almost don't think there's a separate lid and box. It's like Maha Kashyapa's enlightenment when the Buddha holds up the flower and smiles. Nothing else is needed. To me, it's a complete meeting of each moment. It's the mind before it engages and develops interpretations about whatever is experienced. It's a recognition of each moment as complete, like, as the sutra says, like arrow points meeting in midair. It's that sharp, exact meeting without the confusion of karma or the intrusion of self versus other. Is this good for me, bad for me, that can intrude on our experience of the world? Each individual, although we exist as independent units, has a role in co-creating the world around us and through us. We can't exist without the rest of the world. The rest of the world can't really exist without us. The water we drink, the earth we walk on, the food we eat, all support us and everyone else and every other being in an interdependent network. It just wouldn't work if it didn't all function together. A more simple example might be about in hearing a voice. It involves all of these separate elements, vocal cords, vibrations, air, sound waves, eardrums, and a listener or a receiver. Each of these things exists in its own moment as a thing unto itself, but they don't take on any meaning until all of these are brought together in our human perception. But how often is it that we only perceive before we start thinking good or bad or indifferent about something we perceive? Neuroscientists have been able to measure that there are mere milliseconds between the time a sensation is received and our minds react in some way. This assignment of value is a natural human activity because we do, in fact, exist as individuals in a relative world. It allows us to make sense of the world, to piece things together and to evaluate whether something will support or endanger the continued existence of this body. We would miss the words if we just existed in the absolute, experiencing each moment as a single independent event. We'd receive the elements of sound, but we wouldn't hear anything. We'd miss the meaning. I think the next lines in the sutra also recognize that there's a balance that needs to be struck between our discriminating mind and awareness of the Absolute. They say, hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. These lines in the sutra remind me of how fast the analytical mind can swing into gear when faced with uncertainty. Shunryu Suzuki talks about this tendency in his book at chapter 11, which is titled, We Should Not Stick to Words or Rules Too Much. Chapter title alone reminds me of how we can get confused when we always look for things to be black and white when there are so many shades of gray. We box ourselves into a certain way of being, a certain way of acting, and we can't see our way out of a situation. Maybe that's all we have in our toolbox in a lot of situations. We just fall back on some principles that we have received through experience or heard about, or maybe just follow those unspoken guidelines that implicitly guide our actions. When we try to operate our lives that way, pigeonholing everything into shapes that we already know, we miss the potential for what could be. And we also take away our own freedom. We completely miss the middle path or the way through a potentially challenging situation. The next line in the sutra is, if you don't understand the path as it meets your eyes, how can you know the way as you walk? So if you're only using those analytical tools that allow you to see the world in black and white only, you may not realize where you're walking. The path meeting one's eyes is whatever is coming up in the present moment. There it is. You're on the path. It's jumping up to meet your eyes. You can't simply have the path deliver you to Oz by imagining that's where it's going to take you or willing it to be so. No, you need to see it exactly as it is, and if needed, change course. And you can only do that by experiencing the present moment as directly as possible. Another way that fear can overtake a grounded awareness is described in Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Fear. He describes how fear is something that is usually about what may or may not happen in the future. It is sometimes about what is happening in the moment, but usually not. So there's the helpful fear and the not so helpful fear. When you really return to the present moment, is the danger right there? You need to sit with and become intimate with your fear. Feel it elevating your heart rate. Notice it in the tightness of your shoulders, the furrow in your brow. Maybe it's something that you're thinking about will happen later. Thay encourages us as much as possible to relax all the thoughts of what if and return to the breath and the body. The next lines of the sutra are, progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block the way. And to me, this talks about how we're often stuck striving for a certain goal. And if we only see the goal and miss the journey, we're crushed when we don't achieve what we imagine the goal to be. I'm reminded of the walks I take during coffee breaks now that I'm working from home. I have a goal, which is to go out and get back home in a timely way. And because I'm familiar with my neighborhood, I can forget about the goal of returning home for a bit. I don't worry about it. It allows me while walking to enjoy each step, the feeling of legs and arms swinging, the smell of recent rainfall or things growing, and the sound of different birds. I'm not thinking about getting home, and quite often, not really anything else at all. If I'm lucky, my shoulders drop and my neck relaxes. The final line in the sutra is, I humbly say to those who study the mystery, don't waste time. And my interpretation of this harkens back to the early teachings of our Chinese ancestors like Huineng. Know that you are already Buddha. It is not something you can learn with your brain power, but can only experience. It's not a goal. It's there. It's a deep statement of faith, especially in one's own self. So it's our human shorthand to study, analyze, compare, decide what's good and bad as quickly as possible. It's innate in us. It's what our brain does. It's what it's built to do. Things arise so quickly that this relative body has to interpret and make sense of things to ensure our survival and to go forward. But relying exclusively on this means we're stuck in our conditioning, and it just reinforces a sense of self as separate. More and more, we begin to see things only as they relate to ourselves, our sense of security, our sense of well-being. And as I mentioned, these reactions are known as desire and aversion, which the Buddha identified as the source of suffering. We suffer in part because we can never find that perfect state of ease, neither running toward or away, running away from things. And by doing that, we lose touch with the interdependent nature of everything and the warmth of feeling connected to this life. It also makes it difficult for compassion to flow forth. Something as natural as Dao Wu's reaching back for the pillow at night, as he describes to Yunyan in a familiar koan. It's a natural action where the hand doesn't tell your sore neck, don't bother me, I'm sleeping. The hand is, of course, quite separate from the neck, but there isn't some big dialogue that takes place between the two. It's just a spontaneous action. But in our human lives, we don't see things quite so much as an automatic reaction to things, to fluff the pillow, to make the neck more comfortable. We tend to think about how, well, if I do this thing, I'm going to wake up a little bit. I'm not going to be rested for work. And if I'm not well rested for work, I'm going to mess up. And my livelihood might be at risk. So the common word here is I and me. It's the fear that arises as more and more we separate ourselves from everything else. It's the self-concept that arises and gets reinforced as thoughts based in fear feed on themselves if you let them. The antidote, during his talk on the five great fears, the Buddha also taught the four powers that free us from fear. They are wisdom, firstly, and I think this can be found in cultivating self-awareness and not believing everything you think. It's cultivated in Zazen, where we return to the body and breath and find moments of repose. And as we practice, maybe we find that tiny bit of extra space between perception and reaction, or we realize, we have the ability to realize what's going on. It's about becoming intimate with one's fear. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, returning to the present rather than fretting about the future. The second power is energy. I think this is like just make an effort. Maybe things will turn out better than you think, and if not, probably won't kill you. It can also be about launching ourselves into what we don't know with the intention to reduce and maybe even end suffering. It's a practice of allowing oneself to be vulnerable. Geez, I might fail at this. But if it turns out okay enough times, it helps build our trust, which is something that also makes the world a little less scary, but you're not going to know until you try. The third great power is an unblemished life, or I guess living an unblemished life. And I think we can live with less fear if we follow the basic moral principles. In our tradition, it's taught in the precepts. That's because we're not always looking over our shoulder, worrying about whether we'll be caught or worse, punished. In trying to be a good person, the world that gets reflected back at one starts to look a little bit sunnier. And the fourth power, beneficence. It's an old word that was in one of the translations. And this comes back to my original inspiration for this talk, the paramita of generosity. By receiving and offering generosity, we can begin to let go of our defended natures, judgments, caution, second guessing, and demanding black and white answers. It's a practice of breaking down the self versus other dichotomy. It's allowing oneself and others to be vulnerable, to realize our deep interconnection. At the end of his chapter on the paramita of generosity, Norman offers some simple suggestions to cultivate a practice of generosity and help find a greater sense of connection with the world. There are quite a few, so I'll only mention a few here. There are a few of my favorites. Intentionally smile at people, anyone and everyone. Try to feel the inner warmth that the smile outwardly projects. And I think when you do this, I don't know if you've ever tried it, you might find that people are more inclined to smile at the next person they meet, and so on and so on. Do something every day for your health and well-being. Meditation, exercise, healthy diet. It's the idea of taking care of oneself first so you can be ready to take care of others. And finally, of course, my favorite, give the gift of fearlessness. Norman says, this one is difficult, but it is worthwhile to try it again and again. Look at people with eyes of love, respect, and genuine concern. Try to find those feelings within yourself. Thank you for listening. And I'm sure that this topic will continue to inform my studies and thoughts as I go forward. I hope you found it helpful.